now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking all things England. Can Gareth Southgate possibly learn anything from the next two games? And we'll also be discussing some England memories with some journalistic giants. That's right, giants, chaps, that's what you are. We'll also be talking about Antony and another tricky situation for Manchester United, Jordan Henderson's justification for his move to Saudi Arabia. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, as usual, on a Thursday, we've got Martin Samuel, our chief correspondent. But with no Gregor Robertson or Johnny Northcroft today, we've got two super subs that are as good as Sheringham and Solskjaer in the form of chief sports correspondent Matt Lawton and senior sports writer Matt Dickinson. Chaps, welcome to the game. First time this season.
Yes, thank
you. Nice to have you in the flesh. What a lovely experience this is going to be.
Well, am I not coming to London on the hottest day of the year?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, at least we're in an air-conditioned office. At least you got that. Before we get started on all of that, I wanted to begin with the subject of Martin's column on Tuesday, the headline of which was Roy Keane incident inevitable since the shattering of impartiality. The incident in question, of course, involving Keane being the victim of an alleged assault at the Emirates after Arsenal's win against Manchester United. Martin, tell us about your column.
Well, the column was, it's something I've been writing about for a number of years now. It's the loss of impartiality in sports broadcasting. And it's not anything that actually has been done by the pundits or analysts themselves. It's the way the broadcasters want to project everybody these days as a fan of a club, as a super fan, where they show people celebrating goals, they show people, you know, singing "You'll Never Walk Alone" and things like that. And I've always thought that the broadcast suite, as such, it's just a press box. That's all it is. It's a very upmarket press box, and they can go down pitch side, which we can't and stuff, but it's still a press box. And you don't show allegiance in a press box. You don't start jumping around when your team scores. And everyone's got a team. Every single, there's probably not a football writer alive that didn't grow up supporting a team. Why would you ever become a football writer if you didn't actually have a team as such and you didn't feel it in that way? And I just thought that what happened with Roy Keane is what happens once you lose that sense of distance, once you lose that sort of, you're meant to be on the fence, you're meant to have a foot in both camps. And where they project the pundits now as fans of Manchester United, fans of Arsenal, and every station does it. It's not just Sky. You look at the BBC and how they project Alan Shearer and how they project Ian Wright. And you just think, well, in the end, you couldn't stand in the West Stand at the Emirates in an Arsenal shirt, in a Manchester United shirt, no more than you could stand in the Stretford End in an Arsenal shirt. And yet that's where they put these guys. They put these guys in amongst the home fans. And I'm not saying, this is not a mitigation for what happened. There's no mitigation. If the man was assaulted, there's no mitigation for that whatsoever. You should be able to accept that somebody doesn't support the team that you support. But at the same time, I think I would hope that someone, somewhere in the broadcast, amongst the producers or whatever, feel just a little bit guilty about the way they've sort of set these guys up and then sort of shoved them into a football stadium environment, you know. And they're now talking about them needing bodyguards.
Matt, you're nodding along.
Yeah, no, I think Martin's spot on. And, you know, I've just been in Budapest for 2 weeks at the World Athletics Championships, and the pundits they use, the BBC use, are guilty of the same thing. And I find it, I don't like it. I don't like the fact that when Josh Kerr is winning the world title, the you're suddenly watching on the BBC, on Twitter, or X as it's called now, that they're all going absolutely bonkers in the media suite, that all the pundits are all cheering and going crackers. Because I think ultimately it lacks, and I think somebody like Paul Kimmage actually tweeted about it and said, you know, this wouldn't have happened in David Coleman's day or whoever. Yeah. Because I think what it does is it actually undermines the journalistic integrity of people like the BBC, of organisations like the BBC and Sky. And I think that the people that are running these teams, be it the head of athletics at the BBC or the head of football at Sky, they're actually losing sight of the fact that it's still supposed to be journalism. Broadcasting is journalism.
Is it journalism or entertainment? And there is the blurring of. I mean, I think to agree with that point. I mean, I still do think that the best pundits, you know, I mean, Gary Neville with Man United, Jamie Carragher with Liverpool, Roy Keane with Man United, are not, you know, they're not going to suddenly remove all that they bring as representatives of that club. And I think the best of them, the smart ones, are capable of both wearing that outfit and being very good impartial pundits.
Keane probably being the best example.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so it's, you know, I think those guys sort of get the job, but I do think, as you know, as Martin's column said, there are sort of almost sort of forces behind them, production forces, shall we say, which want them as certainly nearer the entertainment end of that spectrum than the journalistic side, and because undoubtedly trying to sort of have the best of all worlds.
I don't blame the guys at all. I'm not blaming all of those guys that I mentioned in the column. I think are very, very good analysts, and I think they're dead straight as well. This is the other thing. You know, the other day I felt sorry for Jamie Carragher when it came over to him at half time of the Newcastle game, and I asked him about the Trent Alexander-Arnold booking, and he said, "Well, it's a booking because he's throwing the ball away." But he was fouled. And he was fouled. There's no doubt about that. He was fouled and the referee missed it. Then they asked him about the Virgil van Dijk sending off. And he said, "I didn't think it was a sending off." I agreed with that as well. I thought it was a booking. It was a card that doesn't exist. It was an orange, as far as I'm concerned. A bit more than a yellow, a bit less than a red. And he said both of those things. But then straight away, everyone says, "Oh, well, that's a Liverpool fan talking," because that's how they've depicted him, as if like this voice of the cop. He's actually just calling it as he sees it.
That replay that you talk about that was happening in athletics, that's become a thing, hasn't it, now?
That
they always cut to, here's you know, Wrighty holding his head when an Arsenal thing happens, or here's so-and-so going mad. And it's just become part of the entertainment, and I guess they're doing that because they think, I mean, people are responding to passion. People like to see that these are not just sort of guys in suits, these are guys who live it and breathe it and care about it as much. And there is a strength to that, an entertainment strength to that, but it is blurring exactly what the role is, I think.
But Roy Keane sits there and stares at them and it almost looks embarrassed by it at times, and I think he's right.
Yeah. Do you think they've lost slightly because of that kind of partisan, the desire for the fan aspect? I sometimes think, you know, because Roy Keane can comment on any midfielder in the world, given his career, but they focus so solely on Manchester United sometimes, and the same with these other players. They've lost slightly, you know. Neville, for example, burst onto the scene of punditry with his Monday Night Football analysis, and that was brilliant, whether it was Wolves or Fulham or Manchester United. Have they gone a little bit too far away from that, Dicko? Do you think they've lost? So we've lost. Actually, we sometimes lose their quality analysis.
And I think actually they don't get the best of Roy out of that as well. I mean, Roy Keane is not a cartoon character. You know, you know as well as anyone. You've done columns with him. I mean, he is a multifaceted, interesting bloke with all sorts of, you know, he's not just the guy who sits there going, "That's a disgrace" about Manchester United. He's got many more interesting opinions than that. So trying to sort of, let's see how angry we can get him about Man United is actually not doing him it's doing him a disservice as well. Yeah. You know, it's not all just about let's get Roy Keane to, you know, his head to blow off, you know, talking about Man United. Let's actually, as you say, get him analysing and talking about, no, actually, this is how you play central midfield.
No, and you're right. Like, I did do many, it's the only column he ever did, and I did it. It was very short-lived, but I think we did about four.
And then he got sent off at Newcastle. I always remember getting the call for it. He got wound up by Shearer and lost his temper and got sent off. And remember getting the call from his lawyer saying he doesn't want to do it this week. And we never got.
you got the second red card.
And we never got him back. But as I say, he is such. And this was when he was playing. This is when he was a captain. But he's got so many opinions. He's such a thinker. That they really, I agree. And I think he does sit there sometimes thinking, you can just see it in his eyes, just looking at them, thinking, can we just have a sensible, mature conversation about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw Jamie Carragher last year, and it was on the American station that he does, and William Malaig was on there and was saying something about how everyone should help contribute to, you know, how the Premier League should contribute more to European football so that they can... so that it balances it out a little bit more. We've got more money than everybody else, so we should start quite literally helping out, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona because they've been suddenly taken potless. And Jamie absolutely destroyed it, destroyed this argument in 30 seconds flat, in a way that you're thinking, yeah, that's what I would have said if I was there. That's you know, go on, you know. Yeah. And he absolutely went for it. And you're thinking, there's a guy. Just, you don't have to have him talking about Liverpool. You don't have to have him sitting there every time Liverpool play. Let the man talk about football.
Gary's monologue about the European Super League was as powerful as demolition of that. It was, it was off the cuff, spontaneous, and it was brilliant, you know.
And now that same guy is doing co-coms on his own football team.
Yeah.
You know, no one at Sky looked at that and thought, it's a little bit on the nose to have the co-owner of Salford City doing co-commentary on Salford City versus Leeds United. That's a just, it's a, you know.
Would you rather they swapped then? Would you rather Carragher never did Liverpool, Neville never did United, and they swapped?
So. I tell you, I wouldn't mind it. I wouldn't, but it's not up to me. But it's just this idea that where people are projected as fans. Of, yeah. And we all know footballers, and it was a job. And we all know Gary Neville wants to win, and Jamie Carragher, and Alan Shearer, and Gary Lineker, and Ian Wright, all know they want to win. You just don't need it sort of thrust in your face all the time. Mm. That, you know, because then people start questioning every single thing they say, because they see it all the time. You don't see a guy giving his honest opinion. It's like it's come from the middle of the Stretford end. And that's not fair on those fellas. It's just not fair on them.
I wonder whether there are listeners of this podcast thinking about journalists then, and journalists in, you know, first and foremost journalists, because these guys are footballers, now journalists and pundits. How do you guys feel then about being fans? And, you know, Martin, on your very first show, we outed you as a West Ham fan, of course.
Yeah, which I never like, but you know, I can't deny it, you know, because I've written about it.
Exactly.
But I never like it being talked about, really. But
let's talk about it.
Okay, but I've written about it. But all I would say is, I've sat in the press box and watched what is my team go from 3-1 up in an FA Cup final to 3-3, and no one would have known I supported West Ham.
Mm-hmm.
No one. I've never jumped up in a press box. I've never punched the air in a press box. I've never done anything like that.
As someone watching my teams, I do out myself.
All your teams are rubbish.
I've never had reason to punch the air.
No,
whether in a press box or not. But no. I mean, I think that, you know, there are certain times when your work is informed by it. But I think the crucial thing is just to be upfront about it and, you know, acknowledge it. I mean, I did a column on Michael Beale leaving QPR, but, you know, literally put this is written by the guy sitting in our block rather than the guy in the press box. I think you just have to own that, depending on what type of piece it is.
We had an Italian journalist in the press box at Wembley for the European Championship final.
Yeah.
Who actually put on his Italy shirt for the penalty shootout?
Blimey!
And started screaming in the faces of some of the English journalists when they then won. Who was then removed from the press box?
Probably censored.
It was before, so different standards for different. You know,
probably censored.
When you're travelling around, you do sometimes find that in different countries. And English journalists, you know, have been guilty of it as well. But you do occasionally find that you are sitting near somebody who's going absolutely bonkers.
There was
no, but we had one in We had one in the Euros in 2004 when
absolutely.
Greece won,
but,
didn't we?
Yeah, but it was an English journalist, but he wasn't supporting England.
Of Greek descent.
Greek descent.
And winning 5-1 in Munich, there was famously a colleague of ours who, I think when the fifth goal went in, got a cigar out.
Well, that's just because he doesn't need a tour rewrite. He knows England have won. Yeah. There are lots of England stories to come. I just want to finish on this one. Do we think... We're talking about Roy Keane, we're talking about Manchester United, we're talking about Jamie Carragher, we're talking about Liverpool. Even, you know, West Ham, you know, you're talking about QPR. Greg has joked with me about this before. He's like, you're fine outing yourself as a Lincoln fan. No one's going to be offended by a Lincoln fan being on a podcast.
Being a Leicester man.
Well,
when
exactly.
They won it,
do we think that's part of it as well? That you know, there are certain clubs within a block, you know, who listeners of this podcast, you know, Alison Rudd being a Liverpool fan, I know friends of mine who listen to this podcast who struggle sometimes to accept Alison's opinion because they hate Liverpool. Yeah. Not because they hate Alison Rudd, but because they hate Liverpool.
Well, no,
do we think that's
Roy,
part of it?
And also, you know, the fact is that, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of occasions where Roy has been in, you know, a pub or somewhere and someone's just thought, I'm going to have a pop at him because he wants to tell his mates in the pub, tell his other mates, you know, I just stuck one on Roy Keane. So... But yeah, so I think there's always going to be that when you are associated with a club, you know, anytime you know, Gary goes to Anfield, he does those, doesn't he? Of the sort of, you know, pulling his cap down and sort of seeing, you know, can I get through here alive? So that's going to happen. But I do think it was an interesting sort of lever into a wider discussion that we've had about actually. Is it TV's job to project this sort of fandom, and is it actually what we want, and or do we want more sensible, shall we say, analysis rather than this sort of, you know, we're fans getting excited?
Maybe they need more QPR and Lincoln fans on the Sky Sports ticker. Maybe there's a future for us after all. Now, talking about big clubs and bigger problems, Manchester United, we want to talk about them. Anthony, the United winger, remains part of their squad after the club resisted calls to suspend him following accusations by his ex-girlfriend that he had assaulted her on several occasions. Brazil, however, have removed him from their squad, but United did not follow suit. Now, after the Mason Greenwood situation, which we discussed at length on various episodes of this podcast, is this another situation which United are not handling very well, Martin?
Well, the only reason I would say this, and I had a degree of sympathy for United over the Mason Greenwood situation, because on the morning that they woke up to that news, same as everybody else woke up to that news, it would be very uncharted territory. You know, there's been accusations against footballers in the past, of course, but that was a very graphic accusation put out on social media, very much inserted to the public domain. And, it, you know, they had to start making decisions on the hoof on that. But what I do remember is by the end of the day, before there was any charge or anything, he had been suspended by Manchester United. So we can say that on the morning they woke up, there was no actual playbook, for want of a better phrase, for how to deal with this situation. But there is now. Mm. There absolutely is now a playbook. It's what they did with Mason Greenwood, where they suspended him from the club, pending the investigation, their own investigations. They actually, when people say, oh, there isn't a process, why don't they put a process in place? Well, actually, there is a. If we're talking precedent, there is a process. They have dealt with this situation before, and quite recently, and that was the action they took then. Now, where he's been named in their Champions League squad going forward, Anthony, I don't know what is greatly different in the actual circumstances, because they have dealt with this before.
Taps nodding along.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. I think any decision has to be evidence-based, and I think perhaps if there's a difference between the two cases is that there was obviously evidence in the public domain related to the Greenwood case that while obviously the CPS... chose not to advance the case. There was stuff that was difficult to unhear and also unsee. So I think that was much more a compelling case for United to act. I think with this one, as I say, there's evidence emerging from Brazil.
obviously statements have been made. I think they are within their rights to some extent to try and, you know, it's a bit like being journalists. Everything you try and do is evidence-based. Mm. Every judgment you make is evidence-based. So I'm sure they're taking it very seriously because they have to be seen to be doing the right thing, and they have to protect the reputation of their football club. And as they have at least demonstrated with Mason Greenwood, it can't just be about value of assets. Mm. You know, everyone knows that Mason Greenwood potentially is a footballer worth, you know, in excess of £100 million, but you have to make correct ethical, moral decisions on these matters. I just think they probably need to understand more about what's actually happened here before they make a decision on a player's career.
Mm. Speaking of Greenwood, what did we make of his reception by Getafe fans in Spain this week?
Depressing. Yeah, I you know, young girls in the crowd high-fiving him, and you know, sometimes, you know, football fans can be blind to a lot of issues, can't they? If they think they're getting a good player or they're getting suddenly a massive investment in their football team, they don't care. But I did find it a bit depressing. Yeah.
It's another difficult situation for Manchester United already in this season. We're going to move on because we want to get on to talk about some actual football with England, which we're going to do very, very soon. But another footballer who this week has been in the news, not for his skills on the field, is Jordan Henderson. This week has spoken about his move to Saudi Arabia and given one of those apologies, well, not really apologies. It's ones we try in our fights with our better halves, isn't it? Well, I'm sorry you felt like that. Which never gets very far with me, let me tell you. He's given a sort of apology to the LGBTQ community, saying, "I understand the anger about his move to Saudi Arabia. I get it. I'm sorry that they felt like that. My intention has always been to help these causes." Now, one man who wasn't buying it was you, Matt Dickinson. You wrote this week a response on the Times website. You're not having any of it, are you?
No, I mean, it was a very long, you know, extensive interview. He was asked all the, I think, you know, the right questions, and gave just a lot of very sort of implausible answers, whether that was about, oh, you know, I never thought about the money, you know, that was sort of almost incidental, really. I think, you know, he tied himself totally in knots on the whole, you know, issue of, shall we say, rainbow laces. It was like, well, we need to respect everyone's, you know, I'd like to promote the cause, but I'm not going to offend Saudi Arabia, but I respect the right to, it basically ended up saying, I respect the right to lock up gay people because I need to respect their views, but I'm also respecting the right of gay people to be gay people. I mean, it just, the more he said, the shall we say, the more confused and naive it sounded. And he tried to cite the Qatar World Cup, saying, you know, we sat down before with the England squad and Amnesty showed us all these terrible pictures of labour camps, and you know, and we went out for the World Cup, and it was lovely. You know, what was all the fuss about? And it was just, yeah, a friend who was Sports PR texted me and just said, the first rule of PR is never make something worse.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was one of those interviews that pretty much made everything worse. Yeah. You know, if he wants to go to Saudi Arabia, absolutely fine. There are plenty of other sportsmen, you know, who will be going there over the next, you know, 10, 20 years, because they're going to throw enough money to attract them over. But just be straightforward about it. Mm. I mean, I cited in there was a LIV golfer who trotted out all the sort of grow the game guff nonsense, and ended up speaking to him on the drive on a practice range at Wentworth, and he was just heading his hands going, why did I come out with all that nonsense? You know, I should have just sat there and said, my career's near the end. I've been offered a stupid amount of money. I'm afraid, like it or not, I'm going to take it.
You say that. I mean, how do we feel? I mean, you know, I sit on the editing desk and ring, you know, reporters ring in from press conferences. Oh, I've talked about this move. I mean, have we ever had a footballer or any sportsman say, I've gone for the money? There's absolutely loads of it and I need to take it. Because there is an aspect of where Henderson, if he
I quoted Andy Murray in the piece, just said, Andy Murray, you know, and I thought it was, you know, Andy Murray is, I suspect we'd agree, is one of the most impressive sort of athletes we deal with. And for, as he has seen the Saudi, you know, incursion into sport, he's basically said, no, I'm not comfortable with it. I would not go there for silly money for exhibition games. And then very recently he said, actually, I'm now gathering that there's going to be some proper tournaments there. And if there are, I might end up going because I'm not going to sacrifice ranking points. I'm not going to sacrifice my career for that. And he said, you know, this is unfortunate, but I'm going to be pragmatic about that. And I just thought that was a pretty grown-up, straightforward way of just saying, it's not a dilemma I want, but this is the way I'm leaning, and I don't. But
Rory McIlroy's essentially arrived at the same place, hasn't he?
Exactly.
You get to a point where you can't swim against the tide, and there's no point. The ship has sailed, and I just think, I think Jordan Henderson's mistake, and I think everyone in this room has dealt with him, has always liked him. He's what you generally viewed him as, one of the good guys. And I can still see why Gareth Southgate wants him around, because, you know, I always remember that England game behind closed doors in Croatia.
The
I think
only
it
voice
was
you could hear on the field.
The only voice. It was so obvious that he was the leader of the team, even though Harry Kane was wearing the armband. He's you can see why certain Liverpool players came out when he went and just were gushing in their praise of the way he mentored them, supported them, led them. And I just, I totally agree with Matt's column. It was almost insulting everyone's intelligence. You know, of course it's about the money. The only reason to go there is for the money at the moment. What other appeal is there? There would have been 10 Premier League clubs if his agent had picked up the phone that would have taken him, I'm sure. Because why would you not take him? Mm. You know, he could have just played at a different Premier League club and continued to play in the Premier League. But nobody would have been offering the astronomical sums, and that's the reason you do it. Because I was looking at it, and I was actually looking at it. You know, he lives quite near me, Jordan Henderson, and I kind of know where he is. And
bigger house, or
I don't know. Actually, no, of course. Yeah, I think my house would fit in his garage. But no. And you think, why would you when you've got that amount of money, why would you spend 2 years of your, if we get 70 or 80 good ones, if we're lucky, why would you spend two of those there, playing there, when you could still be playing in the Premier League? And it's just got to be because the money was so ridiculous that you couldn't turn it down.
Mm. Martin?
Well, I think it's a reckoning that everyone will have to make in the end, because if you look at the WTA, for instance, there's a tournament there, a tour there that is in financial crisis. It's been doubts about how long it can continue, and what's coming over the horizon to save it could be Saudi Arabia. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do if you're a female tennis player? Are you going to take the course where, you know, you stand up for women's rights and at the same time your tour tanks and that's it? Or are you going to go, well, we've got no choice here, we're going to Saudi Arabia, and what we'll have to dress it up as, we're furthering the sport and we're changing minds and we're changing attitudes? And the changing of minds and attitudes is the one that everyone hides behind, but it isn't going to happen, because it either bleeds into a white saviour narrative where we're going to go to the Gulf and we're going to save everybody from their own religion, basically, and from themselves and from their own customs and culture, or you've got to admit that you look at Qatar now, nothing much. They've got a women's football team that doesn't play, for instance. Try and find the Qatari women's football team in the world rankings. I don't think they're there, because ostensibly it exists, but they don't actually play. And so nothing really changes. Mm. You're not going to, who are you to try and change it? But if it is up to us to change it, how is it going to change?
Well, and certainly, and that's where the Henderson, back to Henderson and rainbow laces, it was sort of, you know, I'd love to wear them, but I won't if it offends anyone.
Exactly.
That's,
which it will. But, which it will do, because they're graying out.
If you're talking about changing anything, that doesn't strike me as, you know.
The one danger, and it's not necessarily sympathy for Jordan Henderson, but the one danger that you have here is that the only way that Jordan Henderson could have avoided a backlash, and the reason there is a backlash against Jordan Henderson, is he has been very vocal on the subjects of gay rights and things like that, and homophobia, and he's been very vocal on that subject. So there's other players that have gone there that are getting a far easier ride simply because they've never stood up for anything in their lives. And it's bounced back on him more than on anybody, because he did actually stand up for something when he was over here. And we can say, well, he's a hypocrite and all that, and you can't argue against that. But if you think that Saudi Arabia is going to be anything in the future or something that you could possibly get involved in,
you might duck it.
The way forward is to say nothing.
I thought on anything. I did think about that point, and I think it's a good point to make. And at the same time, I would say that, you know, we know that Jordan Henderson is big enough, you know, he's thick-skinned enough. I mean, all he's been through in his career, the amount of times he's been written off stuff. That's why I think I was disappointed in the interview, because of all the people, I would have expected just to say, you know what, you know, he did the interview, he must have known what was coming, and I just thought, just be Jordan Henderson. Just, you know, it's a challenge. Dive into it and be as straightforward and as sort of wholehearted. You don't need to come out with this guff that people is clearly guff. He could have just said, I was offered a crap load of money, silly money, I couldn't turn it down. And an apology might have sounded genuine in that sense, if he feels like, actually, I am sorry, I'm upsetting people who had actually invested some sort of hope and belief in me. That apology would have sounded plausible if the interview had not just come with what felt like mountains of sort of PR spiel attached.
Yeah, because in 15 years' time or 10 years' time, whether it's the Olympics or the World Cup, and Martin Ziegler wrote about it, you know, just the other day, there's going to either be 20,000 Olympians descending on Saudi Arabia, or there's going to be however many teams the World Cup is now descending on Saudi Arabia. Yeah. It's an unstoppable force. We published it. There's a great bar chart that we published recently, which is how much money Aramco makes in every financial quarter. And then next to it was a bar chart of Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, Tesla, you know, Elon Musk. Yeah. And even together, they didn't hit what Saudi oil makes per quarter. It's an unstoppable force.
It is.
We're all going to be there. Mm. Yeah, if we've all still got jobs, obviously.
Yeah.
But we're all going to be
after this podcast.
exactly. We're all going to be there, sitting in press boxes in Saudi Arabia, covering the diving and the hockey and the. You know what I mean?
They don't care. This is the other thing. This is the other great myth about it. The great myth about it is, oh, we'll go there and we'll change, and you know, we'll change what they think, and we'll change it. They don't care. I might have said it on here a couple of weeks ago. The week before Usyk fought Joshua, they executed 82 people. If you cared about what the West thought, you know, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't juxtapose having a world heavyweight title fight on your territory and executing 80 people. I think it was either a couple of weeks before. On the week that we all got there for that fight was when the woman was put in home arrest for 20-something years for retweeting support for a dissident or whatever, and she was put under home arrest for 25 years or something like that. And that happened, I think, on the Monday, and the world's press were arriving on the Tuesday. So we do flatter ourselves a little bit if we think, A, we're going to change this whole region, and B, that they want to be changed. Because when you go to Qatar, for instance, all the fuss that was being made about you can't get a drink at the matches, they can't understand why you would need to have a drink at the match.
Well, we bumped into, there was an English teacher who'd worked a long time in Qatar, and I still remember it's because a lot of the times it is in that sort of detail that you sort of find out that the reality of it. And he worked at a school, and it was near the end of the World Cup, and they'd basically had a memo around the school saying, you've had your fun, we've had the girls coming in football tops and wearing shorts and stuff. The minute this tournament is over, the fun, you know, that ends. Don't think you're not, you know, back to coverings. And that's that's their that's their culture, their belief. But it was just really underlined that this, the idea that Jordan Henderson is saying, the World Cup was, you know, it was great, and you know, culturally it seemed so free, and Labour camps, what you're talking about. I mean, it was to judge anything from what is seen in a tournament is always totally
and a lot
misleading.
Of modernisation in that part of the world is done without them trumpeting it. Some of the things that we would think are, oh, that's, you know, that's modernised, that it's not trumpeted, because the actual population in this are quite conservative and quite morally conservative. They wouldn't actually support a lot of the things that we think, oh, we can go there and liberate them from this thing where, you know, people can't walk down the street paralytically drunk. They don't want to be liberated from that. They're very happy with their culture.
The story that Owen Slot broke, you know, was a perfect demonstration. Martin's point, they don't care. You know, FIFA were in an absolute tailspin when suddenly, days before the start of the tournament, they just said, you know what, we're not selling Budweiser at the grounds. You know, Budweiser paying all this money to be sponsors of the World Cup. And actually, when it came to the crunch, they just said, no, this isn't happening.
Yeah.
And trust me, you know, we were on the ground. FIFA were in their heads blew because suddenly they're having to deal with one of their title sponsors and say, I'm really sorry. And actually, they had a press party at the end of the tournament, and all the Budweiser what they weren't allowed to sell was at the party.
Oh, well, I'm so glad the
was drunk within 10 minutes.
Yeah,
the journalists were literally given 400 cans each.
Well, there you go.
And they looked at them just thinking, well, it's a bunch of savages.
journalists doing their bit as ever, chaps.
It was going to go to waste.
I'd like to add, I'd gone home by this
day. I wasn't there.
No one was there.
It was just Lawton.
I did my best.
they were all there. We have to move on, but an unstoppable force, as you say, Matt, and it will not be the last time we talk about Saudi Arabia on this podcast. Up next, we'll be talking about some actual football chaps, with England preparing to face Ukraine, and we'll be finding out which of these three upset Roy Hodgson, and we'll be talking about an infamous interview with Glenn Hoddle. Stick with us.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
England face Ukraine on Saturday in their European qualifier, hoping to further cement their place at the top of Group C, before then taking on Scotland in a friendly next week. Now, on the Times website at the moment, we've got a piece by Paul Joyce talking about Levi Colwill, Lewis Dunk, chance of a new position for Phil Foden. Are we actually going to learn anything from these games? Are we just waiting for the big tournament, and can England actually win it, Dicker?
Well, you've started off mentioning defenders. I think that's probably one area where we do still need to keep learning, because it's been the, John Stones
can't play forever.
What's that?
John Stones can't play forever.
Yeah, and obviously Maguire, we know all he's been to, you know, Southgate's been incredibly loyal to him, and, you know, that's one of, you know, Southgate has been rewarded for that loyalty a lot of the time, but I think we know that that is an area we need to refresh and replenish and strengthen. So that's certainly by whether it's, as you say, Colwell or, I mean, I like Gaye. I think he's a you know, I'd maybe more prefer him in not in a four at the times we played for England, but I just think centre half in particular is somewhere where if I was Gareth Southgate, I would be looking to see new talent coming through.
Mm. You always learn something. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying you learn anything as a fan watching it. You know, if you've got something better to do at 5 o'clock on a Saturday, I would advise you to do it. But Gareth Southgate will learn something. And the example I would always cite in these circumstances, if you go back to, I want to say it's 1995, there's a tournament at home. England play Brazil, Japan, I think it's Sweden, and it's in the build-up to Euro 96, everyone regards it as the most meaningless tournament of all time. What does a manager get out of these three friendlies? And what the manager got out of those three friendlies was a right-back called Gary Neville, who had not played for England until that tournament, and played for England in that tournament, and showed himself to be an international footballer, and was still an international footballer 10 years later. So there's always a chance you get something. Gareth Southgate will get something from this game. But the problem with qualifiers these days is it's so easy to qualify, and so many teams do qualify. It's actually harder to get knocked out almost of a tournament these days before the finals than it is to get there. That, for the wider public, it becomes a bit of a snooze, because if we don't get there by this route, we get there by another route, or we get into a playoff, or we get this. Are we 6 points clear? Mm. We're 6 points clear. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
There's no jeopardy anymore.
Yeah. Matt, I wanted to ask you about Gareth Southgate, and again, referring to, you know, people that you see on social media and some of my friends, you know, when this squad was named, talking about some of the people in it. This is a guy who's done incredibly well for England, been brilliant, someone who you've written quite passionately about his role within England going forward, whether or not he stays as the head coach or not. He is still under pressure, isn't he, though? He remains under pressure. And if and when we, until we win something.
Yeah, he is, because there's a view that he's got a very talented crop of players, and there is a view that actually when it, the view of some is that when it's come to the absolute crunch, for instance, the European Championship final, that he's still slightly lacking in sort of tactical nous. I'm not so sure I entirely agree with that, and I think his great skill, because I do think, and you know, the three guys sitting here, we've all covered a lot of England matches and covered a lot of England managers. I do think international management is quite nuanced, and we've hired the supposedly great tacticians, but there is a lot more to international management, because you don't get to work week to week, day to day with a group of players and actually mould a team. It's much more about being able to galvanise a group of people in a very short space of time and create something that has some continuity to it, that they keep, they come away and then they come back again, and it feels right, and it feels collaborative, and it feels like there's a collective. And I think what Gareth has been absolutely brilliant at is applying all the issues that he saw with the England squads he was involved in, and we always remember his the fact that he was one of the players that wouldn't go and see Mandela on a trip to South Africa because it all felt a bit too much like the David Beckham show. Mm. I think what he's done is extraordinary in the way that he's created this group, and he's removed this fear that seemed to be this burden that was carried by international footballers. And I think with Steve Holland, they do know what they're doing tactically at times. And crikey, you know, we've all sat there and seen Fergie get it wrong in a European Cup final. We've seen Guardiola get it wrong in a European Cup final. The best managers in the world tactically can still get it wrong, because every football match is different and presents unique challenges. And I think it's harsh just to say he blew it when he was tested to the ultimate by the Italians, he blew it. I thought the Italians were the best tournament team in that tournament from the first game, you know, and they deservedly won it. I think he is excellent, and my view, as I've written before, is that the FA, even if after the Euros next year he decides he's had enough, and England fans will obviously hope that this tournament is the one that he gets across the line and wins something. I think it's very hard to assume that's going to happen. The quality of the other teams, not least the French, but you don't let him leave the building. Mm-hmm. If Mark Bullingham has got anything about him, he has got to have a plan that basically doesn't let Gareth Southgate leave the building. He should be the director of football, whatever, the president of the FA, whatever. He should be involved in appointing his successor. He should be involved in the way that St George's Park is run. You've got a guy that's played for England, managed through the junior teams, been the technical director, and has been the best, most successful England manager, you know, since 66. You can't let that leave. I don't care if you've got to pay him three times as much as you pay the CEO. You can't let that leave. He's only 52 years old, or he might be 53 now. I know he's same year as me, but you can't let that leave. You can't let that expertise leave. If the FA allow that to leave, they're making a terrible mistake.
Martin, do you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I thought he would go after the Qatar World Cup. I've never seen a guy look so absolutely flat after we lost to France. He came out and gave every impression of being a guy that was done. Like, it was just like, this is beaten me. I've done three tournaments now and it's beaten me. And I was as surprised as anybody when you read David Walsh's piece in the Sunday Times that weekend, and you know, and David knows Gareth probably better than anybody in the press, and wrote the book with him and everything, and David was saying he's going to stay, and you're thinking he's picked himself up quite quickly there to make that decision. But you see him now, he seems the same Gareth as he was before. He doesn't seem as if he's greatly weighed down by the job. Talking very, very positively, once again, about this could be our tournament, we could win this. We've certainly got the players to make a good fist of it in Germany. And I agree with Matt's point. I mean, we have all these ideas of directors of football and strategy and everything. This is a guy that has shown he gets England, you know, really does get England. We've had a succession of managers that you're not sure they got it the way that, you know, you've got to remember this guy was instrumental in reducing pitch sizes for youth players and for younger players, and that whole strategy is interested in a lot more than just the 23 names in that first team squad. He's built fantastic pathways. You know, we talk about whenever anyone wins a World Cup, we're going to do it like them. You know, Spain win a World Cup, we're going to do it like Spain. When France were good, we were going to do it like France. And Clairefontaine, and that's all you read about. We've got a guy within our own association that you could build that sort of philosophy around.
The only doubt on any of this, pretty much agree with every single word, but is obviously if he may have his own ambitions to, you know, he's had one, you know, frustrating, shall we say, to him club time at Middlesbrough when he lurched straight out of the dressing room, you know, by his own admission, wasn't really prepared for it, and you know, I know it will have crossed his mind that he wants to go back into a club environment and sort of scratch that itch basically, that said, I agree with Matt totally that if they don't fight that with everything they've got, then it's nuts. And actually, you know, as an England fan, wanting the best for them, I think he would have so much to offer in pretty much any capacity.
For me, he has, and this is the point that if I was sitting in the CEO's chair at the FA, he has a bigger calling. You know, he has a bigger role in football in this country. He should be the most influential, powerful person in English football in this country. He should be not just what he's already done, he should be determining policy, progress, the way we take the game forward in this country for the next 20 years. Because, and that's the point, and that is a bigger job than any club job he could be offered, because it's actually, he understands as well as anybody how much football means to people in this country, and he is irreplaceable. And he needs to understand that the impact he could continue to have, and the way that he needs to keep guiding, you know, be having his hand on the tiller and guiding it, he should just be the most powerful man in the game. And yeah, because it's Martin's point, he gets England, he just gets it. Like, you know, we brought all these different people in, from Capello to Eriksen, and they had qualities, of course they did, particularly Capello with his track record, but they didn't get it like he gets it.
Absolutely not. And I can remember it, when I was last at the time, so 14, 15 years ago or whatever, going to see Sir Trevor Brooking when he was the head of football development at the FA, and talking to him about reducing the size of pitches for younger players. And it had come about because one of my sons was a goalkeeper and was standing in the same size goal as Petr Cech at the age of 10, playing for the district team. And you knew there was just large swathes of the goal that if you could get it in there, there was just no way. There's no kid is gonna do that. And the other thing that was happening was, that's why we always got these big kids, you know, that's why English centre-halves couldn't play for so long, because it was always about, if you were big and you could kick it into their half, you got put at the back, basically, because, you know, otherwise the goalkeeper was kicking it 10 yards outside his penalty area and the ball's coming straight back at him. Just massive flaws. And so I took my son along, and we sat in, we wrote a double page spread on it in the Times. We sat in Trevor Brooking's office while Trevor said to Cetrus, "Oh yeah, something should be done about this." And I'm thinking, you've got this big sign on your door, head of football development, mate. You know, like, it was as if, like, God, if only there was someone, you know, who could actually, you know, sort all this stuff out. And then it did get sorted out. It got sorted out exactly as that piece envisaged it should be sorted out. You bring the goal sizes down. You bring your boundaries of your pitch in. You know, so we create a better environment to actually hone technical skill. And the guy that was instrumental, or one of the guys that was instrumental in doing that, is Gareth Southgate. Mm. And that has changed. If you look at the technical quality of English players, now if you think that Cole Palmer can't, that's how high the technical quality, you've got to be Phil Foden to get into the Manchester City team. So it had to happen. We had to produce these really, really super technical players. Because that's the direction that football's going in. Yeah. And Gareth Southgate helped doing that. And if he'd done nothing else, if he'd not been the England manager, he would still have made this enormous contribution to English football. Yeah.
So that's the current England manager then. And Martin, you've stepped into the past there, which leads me nicely on. We'd be remiss of me not to have three journalistic giants, as I mentioned at the top of the show.
Yeah, they're coming
old-timers, that's the other phrase.
Yeah. I mean, you can take it from that if you want. You can take from that one, but there's no doubting that you've covered England a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about some of your favourite stories from the past, and I wanted to start with managers, previous managers. And obviously, I want the juicy goss. I want the best managerial clashes from down the years. And Matt, you were telling me about a little run-in you had with Roy Hodgson at one point.
Yeah, he there's long been an obsession.
He's a nice guy, Roy. How could you fall out with
Roy? He's a lovely bloke, and still will pick up the phone now. And he's an absolutely charming man. I've got a lot of time for him. But he was rather surprised that the England press pack do like to know what the team's going to be. And this has always been a bone of contention with managers. Some are less, actually, Sam Allardyce, bless him, for the one game that he survived, was quite prepared to share the team before every game. He actually told us that he would just give us the team. because different managers have a different view. Matt and I remember in 2002, after England had gone home, and we started just following Brazil in the 2002 World Cup. And Scolari did not care that everyone knew the team. He did not kick people out during his training sessions. And we knew, we sat there, I don't know if you remember this.
Scolari named his team for the first game 3 months before the World Cup.
But we knew...
Didn't have to hide up trees or anything.
Yeah, exactly. We knew when that he was bringing Cleberson into his midfield, right? Because he did it in the training session and we just knew it. And he didn't care. It didn't matter to him that that the press had the team. But Roy, I always remember, I was walking out of the office on the Friday night, and an agent of another player who, let's just say, had been left out, was quite aggrieved and said, "You're not going to believe this, but he's playing Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain tomorrow." So I did a U-turn, walked straight back in the office and wrote the story that Oxlade-Chamberlain was starting in Hodgson's first game. I hope I'm proved right that this was his first game. But because this is all completely just from memory. And after the match, we're in the press room at Wembley, and Roy stopped me as we're all walking down the steps to go back to the press box, and he went absolutely nuts. And it was just like, what the hell are you playing at? How dare you name my team? You're undermining, you know. He was totally furious about it. And it became a massive debate, because Gary Neville was his number two then, and there were constant arguments about it, and, you know, in a civilized way.
Coming back to the idea that you're an English journalist, therefore you should be protecting the English team by not telling everyone the secrets. Is that being?
Yeah, but I always had the view on that because it wasn't always right, and even though with Ericsson in particular, we were right most of the time, but we did get it wrong. There was a game against Macedonia at Southampton where we hadn't realised that he changed the training session halfway through and suddenly put Wayne Bridge and Ashley Cole on both on the left flank. So we got it wrong. I always felt that if an opposition manager is picking up the Times, the Mail, the Daily Star, whatever, thinks, that's the team. You're taking a bit of a gamble there because it's not necessarily going to be correct. So the idea that any opposition manager is basing it on the back page of an English newspaper that is the team is a risk, because as I say, it's not always right. It tries to be right, but the point of wanting to know the team is to be informed when you come to writing your preview.
Yeah,
it's a newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a newspaper. Our job is to tell people things that they don't know, not say, "Oh, we know this, but we can't tell you about
exactly.
it."
We don't want Macedonia to get any.
And the
tips.
Thing is, and I've always thought this, and I've had this with managers, you know, all the way through about naming the team. If I can find out your team, mate, I am absolutely certain that France can find out your team as well, because it's a village football. People have got agents between, we've got players in the France team, they've got players in the England team. The whole thing's a village. We've got Matt Letizia playing for England against Italy in, I want to say, 1996. I think it's October, November 1996. Yeah. We've got that, back page league, got that story. And it all gets blamed on Matt Letizia's brother, actually, saying it, which is great for us, but, you know, the paper that I was on at the time, because I had that on the back page, and it got blamed on Matt Letizia's brother, because the local Guernsey radio station phoned him up and asked him about our story. He doesn't leak the team, we've got it on the back page. But what I do remember about that, there was only one other newspaper that had Matt Letizia in the England team, and it was Gazzetta dello Sport. That was the only other newspaper that had it, because the Italians knew that Matt Letizia was playing. We didn't tell the Italians that Matt Letizia was playing. They'd worked out that Cesare Maldini had got, you know.
It's our job to try and find out. And it's, you know, and actually back to saying how wonderful Gareth is, but it's been harder actually under him. And one of the reasons it's been harder under him is because in the way he does, he's put responsibility on the players, said that it's your team. This is your information. Now, he would prefer it, rightly or wrongly, that it does not come out. But he's basically saying to the players as a squad, this is your information, this is your sort of secret to share or not. And if you want to, you know, look after yourselves, you don't go off and spout and get, you know, because you're not playing,
tell your agent
and say,
here's the team.
This is the team, and he's left me out, and put it out. You know, so there's a sort of ownership responsibility thing. And I mean, the easiest time to get the team are, of course, when the manager's in trouble, half the squad hate his guts, and you know, and we've all been there through many times with England when that is possible. You almost don't have to try that hard, because you just know that there are disaffected people, and the easiest way to get stories and news is from disaffected people.
And the Matt Letizia story, it was so out of left field. I actually thought at the time when I was told it, that because I'd got the previous couple of teams, and I knew Glenn Hoddle was really upset about this, that his team kept coming out. So when this guy phones me and says, I've got the team for tonight, he said, you're not going to believe, or for tomorrow, he said, you're not going to believe it. And he reads out this team and it's got Matt Letizia in it. My first thought is, Glenn has put this out deliberately to try to flush the sauce out.
Yeah.
He's produced something so outlandish, it's like, you know, the Colleen Rooney thing almost, like, you know, that this is to try and flush the sauce out to see if this guy is the sauce. It didn't help as well that when he read the team out, he had 10 names, and I've gone, you've only got 10 here. And he went, who am I missing? I went, Steve McManaman. He went, yeah, Steve McManaman. And I'm thinking, oh no, this is so this is all over the back page. And I'm thinking, oh no, this one is so fraught with difficulty. This is, you know, I can honestly say, Carl Letizia, when I punched the air when I heard that interview.
But on Hoddle, there was a great one, obviously, where he came out in his book and said that he would be deliberately lying to the media because, you know, he wanted to keep it a secret and did think it mattered to the opposition. So he would put out, you know, he would lie about the state of injuries of players. And then, so of course, having said this on the record, first, I think it was Sweden away, there's a press conference and he sits down and usual first couple of questions, you know, injuries, whatever. And I think he said, oh yeah, Tony Adams is struggling, but then he's going to make the game. And Brian Warno, who never a man to duck the brutal question, said, is he really injured or are you lying?
How did that go down?
The manager's like, whoa, what are you talking about? He said, well, you've admitted you lied to us, so I'm just checking, is this a deliberate lie or not? And it was, that's the trouble. Once you start trying to be a smart ass and you know, you're lying and you're saying you're lying, why should we take any
There was a Glenn press conference once, you guys were probably there, where if you'd have basically written that everybody he said was fit was injured, and everyone he said was injured was fit, you would have got the team right. Because it was the complete opposite. There was another one where he was telling, it was when we were playing Italy, the away game against Italy, Roy Hodgson is in there, because he's Inter Milan's manager at the time, and he's translating for the Italian press. And Glenn Hoddle is giving us what would be termed, where I came from, a lot of old Mother Hubbard. He's giving us a lot of old Mother Hubbard over there, and Roy is telling the Italian journalists exactly what's happening, complete with mimes about where this guy's injury actually is, that Glenn is as good as telling us he's fit, and Roy's looking at the Italian journalists over there going, yeah, it's like, it's, you know, it's calf or whatever, you know. It was ridiculous. It was surreal.
So it was actually blatant hypocrisy when Roy had a go then.
Yeah, totally.
Glenn Hoddle then, Dicko.
Yes.
It's a story we've told on this podcast before, but we have to tell it again. Your involvement, should we say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it wasn't actually me who sacked him, obviously. That was down to the FA, and I mean, it was a different time when I would say back pages of the newspapers, you know, could get a manager sacked. And the FA were more, I mean, you know, I used to say the FA would sort of pick up the back pages and almost decide what to do for a period. That was the sort of relationship that felt was going on. But yeah, I mean, I say I did the interview, which I'm sure people know about. And I'd say there was sort of one myth that's got attached to it, which obviously Glenn himself may have done some, fueling of, is the idea that this was the great loss to the national team. Mm. That, you know, if we had not lost Glenn Hoddle, the trajectory would have been sort of onwards and upwards. Mm. And compared to, you know, Martin knows them better, but compared to, say, the loss of Terry Venables, I don't think that's it's even an argument. I think, you know, Glenn, the fact is that after the reason Glenn lost his job was in part, obviously, what he said to me, which, you know, was, you know, offensive to a lot of people, and obviously particularly with disability, but it was also in the context that his regime was, the wheels were falling off.
Mm. Mm.
There were a lot of players who were disaffected.
Yeah,
there were a lot of players who were disaffected during the 98 World Cup. They'd started the qualifying campaign for the Euros terribly, you know, lost in Sweden. Ince gets sent off, does a V sign to the bench. They had a stinker against Bulgaria, I think, 0-0 at home, which was just dire. Mm. Things were going wrong, and that was the context of it. Terry Venables gets, basically ousted at a high point. I mean, you know, that the trajectory definitely looks onwards and upwards. There's obviously all sorts of other baggage involved about, you know, the off the field stuff there. But it was a time when the FA were tying themselves in knots with all the off field stuff in a way that I think that they've sort of learnt some lessons on that as well.
Mm. Martin, any of managers that you've had good run-ins with? Or you're friends
really.
To all?
I'm pretty much, I've never really had a problem with too many, you know, because...
What about some of the, you know, Matt mentioned them before, Capello, Ericsson, you know, we're talking about Hoddle and Hodgson there, you know, English managers for the English team, but some of the foreign managers...
Well, I should say, not to make him blush, but, you know, when I was the football correspondent at the Mail and Martin was there, he got what for me was the best England story of Capello's reign, which was the reinstatement of John Terry as captain, which was an extraordinary decision given the circumstances by which he'd lost it the first time. I'm right in remembering that.
No, you are, yeah. Absolutely.
It was an extraordinary story. That was, you know, that was...
Did they have different ways of dealing with... The press
pack. Capello once said, it was in South Africa, wasn't it, tournament, and he'd been messing about with the goalies, and let's just say I had quite good contacts at the time with one of the goalies. that doesn't really.
as you used to call him, by the way.
I just thought it was basically Capello. Understood. Yeah, they were going, the goalies were literally sort of going into the day of the game, not knowing who was going to play, and basically trying to, you know, just say, how can that be good management? And I remember Capello just going to think, you think you're a manager, do you? With such contempt, you know. Yes. And it was just like, I guess you are Fabio Capello. But, I mean, that's the point. He was Fabio Capello, and yet, to me, was making stinker decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one. I just thought he handled that. How can you have two goalies who are already... basically on edge and not feeling confident, and that lack of confidence is undermining their performances. Yeah. And you're making it even worse by leaving them completely up in the air about who's going to play.
It was interesting though, because he did try and help. The interesting thing about Capello was, while he didn't really have much time for us, he did have Franco Baldini, who was a point of contact, who would try and guide and advise and give us help. And it was... but there was an extraordinary situation just before that World Cup where, at the time, the FA, I think they didn't have a chair, didn't have a chairman, didn't have a chief executive. And suddenly we were all called to this press conference in London by a big PR firm in London. And Adrian Bevington, who was the head of comms at the time, hadn't been informed of it, but had turned up and was, I always remember, was sitting at the back of the room. And it was the unveiling of this thing called the Capello Index.
Oh, yeah.
And they just hadn't thought it through, because it was suddenly like there was this realisation during this press conference that basically we were going to go to the tournament.
And this was the thing where Capello was going to rape people.
Well, he'd put his name to this index. Right. He wasn't going to sit down at the end of every game and give everyone a mark out of 10. But there was some kind of algorithm that was going to do it for him. But it was just the car crash of... you know, it would include the England team. So the Capello Index was going to give, you know, it was almost like we were always thinking, well, we won't bother with that, we're doing ratings. Yeah. We'll just take his ratings.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it was suddenly, I always remember the PR guy that was there going, I mean, us saying to him, you haven't really thought this, the car crash that this is, have you? And it was binned, of course, they had to
straight
bin
away.
It. And I just remember Adrian Bevington at the back, just his, sort of, oh my God, you know, this is horrendous.
The great thing with Fabio, I think the great thing with Fabio was that his command of English wasn't that great. He didn't know that much, but it was almost impossible for him to lie. That was he was a perfect England manager in many ways, because it was the opposite of, say, Glenn, who would deliberately sort of steer you up blind alleys and dissemble and everything like that, because Capello couldn't lie. So the first time we all sat around, you would have been there. Probably both of you guys would have been there. We were all sitting around this table with him at this hotel in London. He was being introduced to the British press. And he's talking about the sort of centre-forward that he wants. And was it Vieri? It was another Italian striker. He was talking about this Italian striker. Yeah, it was one of those guys. One of those big guys that could hold the ball up, play back to goal, and bring the midfield in. And he got there in the end. He got Emil Heskey, and that was Wayne Rooney's most successful qualifying, you know, when the qualifiers as the top scoring world football or whatever. And but this is what he wanted, and he's talking about this, and we're talking about. And so it's gradually, you know, everyone around the table is looking at us thinking, this isn't Michael Owen. This is not Michael Owen.
Mm.
So somebody then said, so where does Michael Owen play in that system? Now, with any other manager, there would have been some answer that would have gone on for about 10 minutes, yeah. pretty much like this one, and it would have gone on for about 10 minutes, and you'd have been nowhere at the end of it, trying to cut yourself through a thicket of words. Capello didn't have the capacity to do that, so he just looked at us and went, number 12. We all went, at this point, this is a lot of meet and greet with the British press, and the FIA are there like, oh my He's God, it's just said Michael Owen can't get in the team. And it was just, and there were lots of examples like that. I remember someone saying to him at a press conference after a game, Theo Walcott had a good game, didn't he? And he just looked at him and went, no. That was it.
Bring well, back on the limited English speakers.
Yeah. But I mean, if we want on just on selection, to be honest, we could probably be here for hours talking about sort of favourite, you know, selection questions, press conference ones. I mean, one that should probably get airing is, of course, the. It would have been pre. Anyways, when Sven was in charge and the Ulrika stuff had all blown up, but of course, we turn up at a press conference. And, you know, the FA obviously just desperately trying to sort of control it, and he's committed to doing a commercial thing, and all the media are there, and it's like, you can only ask about football, you only ask about who he selected, whatever. So, of course, first question is, you know, you've picked your squad, whatever. If you did have to make the choice for your squad, would it be Nancy or Ulrika?
There's always a way around it. Now, we got moving on from managers, captains then. A great position in English sport, the England football captain. Which of the captains that you've dealt with over time have taken it the most seriously, would we say? Arguably too serious.
Can I just say, I've always had a sort of slight take on this, is that we've over, and I don't think we do now, but I think, again, for a lot of, you know, my time covering England, we overplayed it. It was, my sense was always, this is the least of our, you know, we're back to looking for the saviour, we're back to looking for, you know, Captain Braveheart. Roy of the Rovers to drag us out. But to your point, we need to worry about who can pass the ball, who can control it. Captaincy, that was back to the old English default thing of, if in doubt, roar a lot, try harder. And I think, again, as part of the shift of the last 10 years, you know, we care about the captain. It's a hell of an honour. I'm sure it's, the players who are in contention for it, who end up wearing the armband, you know, that's one of the great things in your career. You Absolutely. Have captained your country, but it needs to be kept in its rightful place, which is, it's an honour, but it is not what wins us tournaments or, you know, as, and back to that point, Harry Kane wore an armband, Jordan Henderson was there shouting around. You know, you need, a top team will have five or six people who are capable of being perfectly good captains in that team.
But in those moments, in those press conferences then that you guys are privy to that, you know, listeners aren't, which of them are engaging with you as journalists? Which of them see you as the enemy more than others?
I don't think they ever saw us as the enemy. I think they were all pretty engaging. But I think David Beckham elevated it to a level that I think probably took it a bit too far. I think when he hosted his own party before, I think, the 2002 World Cup. And the England manager was one of the guests. And I think that's elevating the role too far. It was called a Diamonds and Sparkles party or something. I can't remember, but it was.
What was your outfit, man?
We weren't. Well, did you go, Dickhead? But no, I wasn't invited. But I had a few clashes with David over the years. But he really, I'm not saying he exploited it, but it became a big part of his sort of identity. His brand was being England captain. And there would be press conferences that were, held just by him as England captain. And I always remember one where, we were talking about this earlier, but I remember one where it was him, and I think it was somewhere like the Ritz or the Cafe Royal. So it was a press conference that all the football correspondents were invited to just to talk to the England captain. And at the end of it, he took issue with a piece that Rob Shepherd at the time, who was the Express football correspondent, and Rob had written this column where he'd made the point that not only could Beckham not get to number one, he'd just finished second in the World Player of the Year, FIFA thing, but nor could Victoria. She'd been beaten to number one by Sophie Ellis-Bextor and Groovejet.
A scandal.
Neither can get there without their team.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was the theme of the column. Neither could get there without their team.
So Rob's written this column, and we get to the end of this perfectly calm press conference, and David basically says, right, guys, before you go, I just got something I want to say. Rob, you can write what you like about me as a footballer, you know, you're a football writer, any criticism, I'll take it. Don't appreciate you bringing my wife into one of your columns. What are you even doing writing about music? What do you know about number one records? You know, it's just out of order. And Rob, and he'd never shared this with any of us. So maybe with Martin, who they've known each other since they were kids.
How many number one records has anyone in your family?
Yeah, how many number one records?
Yeah. He says to him.
And Rob said, well, actually, my sister had a number one record. So we all sort of turn around and we go, really? Well, what was the record? What was the record? And Beckham's sitting there, you can see he's starting to think, oh no. And he says, my sister sang Video Killed the Radio Star. So we all love this. So we say to Bex, to be fair, Bex, that's probably better than anything the Spice Girls have done. And to be fair to Beckham, he took it really well. Like, it was game, set and match. You know, Shepherd won that argument.
His sister was a session singer.
Well, I thought, actually, on a sim, I thought you were going to mention the standoff over the Beckham not speaking to the Mail, wasn't there?
The Mail and News of the World over a certain... A story that had been written about, that I hadn't written, but it was about his private life. There had been a controversy around his personal life. And we arrived, basically it was ahead of the Euros in 2004, and they were in Sardinia. And we were flown out for one day. The FA arranged it. We had to pay for it, but it was out of the private terminal at Luton. Flew at sort of 5 o'clock in the morning. And the idea was we would turn up for a day, do the manager, do the players, do the captain, and then leave them alone for a week and we'd get enough material. And I arrived to be told by the FA, you're not welcome at the, as was the guy from News of the World, you're not welcome in the England captain's press briefing. So I'm thinking, well, to be honest, this was the main event of the day. Mm. This is a bit of an issue. I wouldn't have minded being told before I got on an aeroplane at 5 a.m. And to be fair, it was a great show of solidarity from my colleagues because people like Matt and Henry and Sean Custis, who's now the sports editor at The Sun,
without even consulting me, we had a chat on the bus basically on the way and just said, basically, if they're not going in, none of us are.
Right. Yeah, you're not doing that. You're not going to ice it.
The union of, and you won't,
and you got in.
Beckham backed down.
And to be fair, he backed down. And actually, I remember him saying, "I actually quite admire, you know, I admire your solidarity." Actually, yeah.
There you go. Journalist 2, David Beckham 0, or is it 3-0?
No. There's another David Beckham. So he's one of my favourite press conferences when he had the Mohican. And he was England captain. He's got the Mohican. I think we're playing, I want to say we're playing Mexico in Derby. It was one of those golden England nights, basically. It was a Friday night in Derby and a generous invitation. It's been 4.5 hours on the M1. And but before that, there was this press conference and he got this Mohican and kids were getting sent home from school for imitating it and stuff like that. And another newspaper, a right-wing middle market newspaper, sent one of their top people down there who turned up looking like the most sort of, you know, voice of Middle England person you could possibly imagine into this press conference to grill David Beckham over this Mohican haircut. So he gets asked about the Mohican haircut. He gives an answer about his haircut. He gets 3 or 4 football questions. Another question about the Mohican haircut. He gives the other answer about the Mohican haircut, and they might have brought in the skirt or whatever it was in the sarong in that might have come into it as well. And then there's another two or three football, and then there's a third question about the Mohican haircut, and I've never forgot him leaning forward and looking at this guy, and in the campish voice, and there's people that think that he's got quite a camp voice anyway, but this was, he absolutely put it on, and he looked at this guy and he went, "I think you fancy me." It was just this beautiful moment.
Very good.
I should say he was good value.
Yeah. He sounds like it.
He was box office for us writing about him. I'd say I don't reflect on that as thinking he was it's not a negative view of him. Yes, we clashed at times.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of time. I think we've all got a lot of time for it.
Well, it's engaged. And with all of that, all these stories talk about engagement. There is actually a relationship, as you say. Yeah. At times, probably inevitably, it's going to be fraught. But I think the players, captains, managers you struggle with the most are the ones who don't engage. Yeah. I mean, it's just, the whole thing becomes monosyllabic or just becomes you're the enemy to have adult conversations,
and we started this conversation talking about the professionalism of journalists. There was when he gave his farewell press conference, and it was very moving after they got knocked out in Germany, and he was crying, and he was saying, with us, and we'd been on the journey with him, and these guys particularly who were, I wasn't in Saint-Étienne, but these guys were, but that whole journey, and he's resigned as England captain. And he's not with us anymore, but there was this extraordinary moment as he then gets up and he's very emotional, and Bob Cash from the Mail on Sunday suddenly jumps on the stage and he's armed with a marker pen and a shirt. The most inappropriate request to sign a shirt in the history of football. It was just like, now's not the time, Bob. Get someone in the FA.
Let him get off stage.
Yeah. Not now. But bless him. He turned around and he signed it. And he walked off.
Do you know what? I was about to close a minute ago saying 2-0 to the Germans over David Beckham, but that's got to be 2-2, hasn't it? He's scored a late equaliser.
Well, he's always said, because it was Daley Thompson, wasn't it? Isn't he always said he queued up when he was a kid, I think. It was at Crystal Palace once, and I'm sure it was Daley Thompson. He went to get an autograph, and Daley sort of brushed past, and he always said,
I think that counts for kids, though, Dicko, not journalists.
And I think you're fairness to Bobby.
I've got a knockback from Tommy Steele once, and I've never watched half a sixpence since.
Oh, there you go, then. 2-2, David Beckham versus the journalist, I think, after that. Matt Dickinson, Matt Lawton, and Martin Samuel, thank you very much for joining me. If you enjoyed this episode of the Game Podcast, make sure you're subscribed, and we'll be back on Monday.
If you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.